today we're going to take a look at a comparison and a contrast between two characters. And the characters we're going to be looking at are Mary, the sister of Lazarus, and Judas Iscariot. And we're going to look at them according to Matthew's version. He gives us, in the first 16 verses of Matthew chapter 26, he gives us this contrast. And it's a really important contrast. And in terms of discipleship and settling in our hearts once and for all what a true disciple looks like, this is it. Honestly, in all the examples that we've had of discipleship up until this point in the Gospel of Matthew, there's none that is more profound than this one that takes place right slap in the middle of that passage. So we're going to look at that passage, but I also want to take a look at a couple of other things, a couple of other scriptures. So I'm not actually going to start by reading Matthew 26. I'm going to start by reading something from the book of Psalms. Will you turn to the book of Psalms? And Psalm 45 is where I'm headed. Psalm 45. Now, some of you have been attending church here for a while, and so in the last few months you've heard some interesting comments regarding our goal, our purpose, our long-term prize. And I've talked a lot about how Jerusalem in the natural was not God's prize for us, and it's never meant to be. And how the Jerusalem that is from above, that is God's prize for us. It's the city that God has built, the city that has a foundation, but his builder and maker is God. And that city is the city where Christ will be enthroned forever. And it's an interesting thing. When we looked at the end times last week, we didn't really go into it in any big way, but there's a lot of expectation that Jesus will set up a kingdom here on earth. Of course, that's related to that millennium rule of Christ. But I want you to know that all the things of this world are going to go up in smoke. One big conflagration, it's all going to be burned up, including the things that we love and find so precious. It's all going to be made new. Actually, that's good news. That's good news. It's good news for some and bad news for others. It's bad news for those who put their trust in what they've built here. But it's good news for those of us who have abandoned all sense of obligation to the ways of the world and have set our hope fully on, and have set our affections fully upon Christ and upon his appearing. Well, we've looked at that and we've seen some very important things. And this passage we're going to read today from Psalm 45 is best interpreted in the light of that. Psalm 45 is a bridal psalm. It's a psalm that basically rejoices in a marriage that is about to take place, and it is a contemplation of the sons of Korah, a song of love. It's a wedding song. And I think many times we can look at look at these things from the natural standpoint and say, well, this is great. Some scribe or some musician wrote this for a royal wedding that was taking place, and we can look at that and say, that's nice. Kind of like we'd listen to a song that was written maybe for the royal wedding we all recently observed on television a couple months ago, and say, well, that was nice, but it has no real bearing on my life. I'd like to suggest that the royal wedding that's being described in this psalm is not, in fact, just some royal wedding of ancient people in ancient times, but it is, in fact, forward thinking. It's looking to your royal wedding, where you, as the bride of Christ, are joined to Christ as our bridegroom. And it is I think it's best to look at this as with an expectation that this is really something that's going to be dealing directly with your own heart. When you do that, the scriptures start to come to life. Some of you maybe read the scripture just from a sort of like you're reading some kind of narrative, or perhaps you're reading something that's just literature. Instead, I want you to see it as a letter that's written directly to you. If you start to read it with the idea that this is written for me, that there's something in this passage that relates directly to me, not just to me as in America, or me as in a Christian, or me as in whatever country you come from, or me as in this family member, you specifically, you with a name, you personally. If you start to look at it like that, God will begin to speak to you through these things and literally change the way you think, the value system that you adopt, and the decisions that you make. All will be affected by that. So in this passage, I want to take a look at just a basic overview, and then I'm going to hit on one verse in there and then move on from that. Okay. this psalm is broken up into three sections. The first section is an admonition it's a recognition of the glory of the bridegroom, the prince who is fairer than the sons of men. The second portion is an admonition to the bride, and it is an encouragement for her to recognize the value of what's about to happen in her life. And then the third part is kind of like the combination of the bride and the groom, and it's just a blessing upon them. So what I want to focus in is the idea, first of all, that Christ is a bridegroom, and therefore he's worthy to be praised. He is perfect. He is without flaw, without sin, without failure of any kind. He is the hero of heroes. He is the ultimate. He is the beginning and the end. He has everything your heart has ever desired. Okay? That's him. He's our bridegroom. Next, in the next portion, you need to recognize that, and this is the portion we're going to focus in on, just really on one verse. As a bride being married into a royal family, there's an admonition that's going to be given. When a bride marries a bridegroom, there's something she loses and there's something that she gains. She gives up her name and takes on his name. Well, that's the tradition. Of course, this is 21st century America, and so some people don't do that in our day and age. However, it is traditional, and there's a purpose behind it. The idea is you're giving up an old identity and taking on a new. God put it this way in Genesis chapter 1. He said, when the two come together, they become one flesh. And what God has separated, Jesus said, let no man separate. What God has put together, let no man separate. So there's a unity and a bonding that takes place there. A father leaves his father's house, leaves his mother. And the truth is, the bride does the same thing. I have a newlywed couple over here. Well, at least Nick's sitting here. She's upstairs with the kids, no doubt. But newlyweds, and you guys have started to discover the amazing mystery of two becoming one, right? And it's a wild ride, that's for sure. But she has to give up. She has to give up her identity. And in this particular passage, the admonition for the church is this: we must give up our father's house and our father's name. What does that mean for us as a church? Essentially, it means this. Peter writes it in his letter. He says, we have not been redeemed with perishable things, even like silver and gold, but with the imperishable, the blood of Christ. We've been redeemed from the worthless traditions handed down to us by our fathers and our forefathers, but given a new and a living hope in Christ Jesus, something new to live for, something different to live for. The traditions of our fathers that were handed down to us were these. You must work hard so that you can earn a decent living, so you can raise your family, so you can gain some notoriety in the world, have a good reputation, and you can be remembered, have a memorial built in your name, and try to become more famous than your predecessors. That's the worthless tradition handed down from our fathers. And we've all been given that. We've all been given that in some way or another, whether it was through our earthly parents, actually biological parents, or through the society that parented us. We've been given these goals, and the goal is that we should become something in the world, be a contributor to the world, be a good citizen and add something to the world, make your mark, right? Haven't you all heard that? How many of you have decided that that's a good goal for your life, to make your mark on this world? Well, you know, in all truth, that's what good citizenship is all about. But there's something more. There's something more. As the bride, we are expected to make a choice. The choice is for us to leave the family we were with and become a part of a new family. How odd would it be if a bride married her groom but decided to live with her dad? Marriage is wonderful. We love it. We're going to have an awesome time. It's going to be great. But every night I'm going home to my dad's house. How would you like that, Nick? He's looking back there at his father-in-law in the sound booth. He's like, I love you, man, but that's not good. I love my father-in-law too, Barry. You guys met him a few weeks ago. He lives in London, and I love him. But I'm really glad that Tammy, when she married me, decided to become my wife. She took on my name, and that allowed us to become one. I'd like to suggest at the beginning of this sermon that we cannot be true followers of Christ if we remain married to the world, or if we remain the children of the world. Christ is inviting us to a wedding. It's our own wedding. He's inviting us to be married to Him, as it were. This is a commitment level. Now, it's an anthropomorphism. It's a way for us to try and understand the intimacy of relationship, whether it actually looks like a marriage as we know it when we're with the Lord. You know, I can't tell you. I don't know. I think it's words that are used to describe a level of relationship, which is only even scratching the surface on the depth of what that beauty and that intimacy is really going to be. There's no way to describe something you haven't seen, so you try and describe using things that you have seen to kind of give an idea, and that's what I think the analogy of marriage is really all about. But the purpose of it is for us to recognize that what we're going to have in the Lord is so far greater than what we have right now that it's worth giving up what we have now to gain what we'll never lose. Do you understand? And that's a critical part of our faith. If we are to become true followers of Jesus Christ, it means we've got to step away from what we have and step into what Christ is offering. And until we do that, we are not actually disciples. Discipleship is a very costly thing. Okay? Can I just make eye contact with you guys? Discipleship is very costly. It's very costly. I've been reading a book, thanks to Richard, he put me onto it, a book by Kyle Eidelman, who's apparently his church is the fifth largest church in America, some 30,000 people that attend church on Sunday mornings. How about that? It's a big fellowship. I can't remember where they're located out of, but he wrote a book called Not a Fan, and I've been listening to it on audiobook this week while I do my run. It's nice to run and listen to something that's good for you at the same time. So I've been exercising mind and body and listening to Kyle while he teaches about this concept of being not a fan of Jesus, as in somebody who's willing to, you know, just shake the pom-poms and say rah-rah and wear the baseball hat, but really at the end of the day not willing to actually make the commitment. He talks about being a true follower of Christ, and I want to recommend that book for all of you. I'm almost at the end, so far, unless he comes up with something really wacky at the end, which I don't think he does, I recommend the book highly to you and say it's probably one of the best books on discipleship I've ever read, and a great way for us to end that whole passage about discipleship that Matthew has kind of given us. Anyway, in the book, he makes it clear that discipleship is costly in the same way that marriage is costly. When Tammy and I got married to one another, it was a very, very firm commitment. It's not a haphazard thing. And the same thing in our relationship with Jesus Christ. It can't just be some haphazard thing. Oh yeah, today I believe in Jesus. And that's all fine and well, as long as there's something in it for me. Somebody called me up yesterday. They were asking for advice. They want to give some advice to a couple who are thinking about getting married. So they were going through some resources, trying to go through some resources to find out what would be good. So this young couple in their mid-30s who've never been married before, looking to get married, they're kind of going through the list and seeing how they are compatible with each other, with one another. And I'd say that's a reasonably good exercise to see whether or not, you know, you're compatible with one another. But the truth is, this is what I said to them on the phone, you could be flying due east and they could be flying due west, and at some point you may intersect with each other, and in that moment you take a test and you say, wow, we're both in exactly the same spot, we should get married. But how wrong you would be. One's going that way and one's going that way. Just for a brief moment, you were in the same place and had the same ideals, but really your destination was different. So that's not always a good thing. I mean, it is important to see how well you're compatible, but the truth is marriage is a commitment, and it's a willingness to be unselfish. And honestly, if marriage is the relationship which is supposed to make us think about our relationship with Christ, Christ and His church, then we really oughtn't to be taking it as lightly as we are. This whole Jesus thing, this whole relationship with Christ thing, this whole I'm a Christian thing, we oughtn't to be taking it quite as lightly as we are. Some of us are still living at Dad's house, but we're claiming that we're married to Jesus. So, Psalm 45, here's the admonition. Listen, O daughter, verse 10. Consider and incline your ear. Forget your own people also and your father's house. So the king will greatly desire your beauty, because he is your Lord. worship Him. I know that was a long introduction to a short verse, but let me read the verse again. Listen, O daughter, consider and incline your ear. Forget your own people also and your father's house. So your king will greatly desire your beauty. There's a suggestion in there that as long as you cling to your own people and to your own father's house, the king will not find your beauty desirable. What makes the bride desirable to the bridegroom is that she's willing to abandon everything in order to be his. That makes her beauty so intoxicating that he will do anything for her. So the king will greatly desire your beauty because he is your Lord. Worship him. Well, that's the foundation, I think, for discipleship. Are you willing to abandon everything for Jesus? And if you are, you will find that the eyes of the Lord will be fixated on you. God will focus his attention. And Jesus will find himself intoxicated with your beauty. You say, well, I'm not very beautiful. I have a lot of inconsistencies in my life. I'm not very holy. I'm not living a righteous life in every way. There's still things I do that are not right, but I want to love the Lord. I want to give him my heart, and I want to be a better Christian. I tell you that the attitude of your heart is what the Lord's looking at. We watched that movie Courageous over the weekend, and Tammy picked this line out of the movie that was just, I don't know how I missed it, but she heard it, and I heard it afterwards when she repeated it. And I said, I want that. I'm going to preach that on Sunday. Here's the line. I can't exactly remember the story, but here's the line. Your attitude is the aroma of your heart. It's the fragrance of your heart. Your attitude is the fragrance of your heart. How's your attitude been recently? How's your attitude? God is looking for a fragrance, a sweet fragrance, a fragrance that is intoxicating. I don't know about you, but there are certain fragrances that I smell that take me places. There's certain fragrances when Tammy wears them, man, I tell you, I'm just like a puppy dog. I'll just follow her around. I will. There's a few of them. She has a few. There's a couple of them, fragrances out there that are just, you know, casual everyday fragrances. She smells nice. It's great. But they don't cause me to pay particular attention. But there are one or two. Usually they're the expensive ones that I can't afford very often. But if she put a little dab on, and a little dab will do you. It's true. I mean, she'll put a little dab of that stuff on, and I am lost to the world. And I will do anything she wants, at any time, at any price. I mean, I shouldn't tell her this in front of all of you, but I'm just telling you, honey, there's a little fragrance. Goes a long, long way. God is interested in your fragrance. And the attitude of your heart is a fragrance before him as well. And the attitude that says, I am willing to give up the reputation that I had because I was good at what I did, or because I was, these are the kind of friends I hung out with, and you know, Jesus is changing me, and I don't want to hang out like that anymore. I mean, I love these people, but what we did together wasn't good. It wasn't righteous. It wasn't sanctified, and I want to give my heart to the Lord. So, but I know that's going to cost me my friendships. The attitude that says, Jesus is more valuable than my friendship, is like a fragrance. It lets off an aroma that gets God's attention. Okay? And it makes him madly in love with you. So this bride is encouraged by the psalmist to let go of all those things, your career, your goals, your family name, sometimes that's very expensive. There are some countries where making a decision for Christ means you get cut off. There are some religions that are so anti-Christ and so scared of Jesus, and for good reason, because he's the truth. that if you start tending towards that, you found with a Bible in your home, or it's expensive.